Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are few people in official Washington or on its margins these days who bring more intelligence to bear on public policy matters of the broadest kind than our guest for, I'm very pleased to say, this full hour. His name is Dr. Tevi Troy. He has served in a number of incarnations in the past, including as Deputy Assistant and Acting Assistant to the President for Domestic Policy, also as the Deputy Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. For a time, he was on Capitol Hill as the Policy Director for Distinguished Senator John Ashcroft, who went on to become the Attorney General of the United States. Tevi is the author of several very important books. We'll be talking about two of them today. The previous one was Shall We Wake the President?, which is a very riveting historical analysis of various disasters being one of the things that are on our plate at the moment. We'll talk about that in a bit. But first, we're going to discuss with him his newest book. It's entitled Fight House: Rivalries in the White House from Truman to Trump. It's so good to have you with us. Welcome back, Mr. Secretary. Thank you for taking a few minutes to talk about Fight House, and congratulations on its publication. Tevi, let me start by just asking you about kind of your methodology in describing these rivalries in the White House. I personally, as you may remember, worked in the Reagan administration, which was riven by some of the most profound ones that I can think of. But talk a little bit about, before we get into particulars, just sort of the broad analytical approach that you took to helping us make sense of why White Houses are often fight houses.
It's a great question, Frank, and I appreciate it. I also appreciate your great service in the Reagan administration, where you did see some exciting and riveting rivalries. Look, I'm a presidential historian who has also worked in the White House, so I think I have two lenses that I can bring to bear on this. And around 2017, the advent of the Trump White House, there was a lot of discussion of this issue of rivalries in the White House. And I asked myself, as a historian, how much of this has been in the past? Is this a media phenomenon? I heard a quote from Peter Robinson, whom I'm sure you know, who was a former Reagan speechwriter, where he said, "Of course there was fighting in the Reagan White House, but we just didn't have Twitter, tweet, or twatter talking about it." So I wondered how much of it was a phenomenon of a specific White House, or was it a media phenomenon? There's more attention paid to this kind of stuff. And I decided to look around and see if anybody had written books on the subject. And I found that while there were some books about individual rivalries, like the book about the rivalry between RFK, Robert F. Kennedy, and LBJ, Lyndon Johnson, I hadn't found anything that looked historically at patterns of rivalries over time. So I decided to try and isolate each administration. I started with Truman because he was the first president to start with a White House staff. The White House staff didn't really exist before that. There was a commission under Roosevelt called the Brownlow Commission, and they came up with this idea that you needed a White House staff, and so late Roosevelt, they started to develop one. But it was really under Truman that you had a first president who enters with a White House staff. And I decided to look at each administration and read up on them and see if there were some kind of rivalries in those administrations that really typified what was going on. And then I did deeper dives in the archives and the oral histories and the journalistic accounts to see what had happened, what it told us, and whether there were overall patterns that I could discern about what works and what doesn't work in terms of keeping rivalries down or ramping them up if the president so chose.
Well, that's the point I wanted to come to, really, first and foremost, is to what extent, Tevi, and I know this would be a sweeping generalization, given that you're talking about quite a number of presidencies, but to what extent is the common denominator here? It really is up to the president whether he tolerates this or not, or whether indeed he actually invites it, in the sense that, you know, there's a sort of constructive chaos that they find useful in sorting and ultimately adopting the policies that they think are best suited to the time.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In the book, In Fight House, I identify three levers that a president has for determining the amount of rivalry and fighting that's going to take place in the administration. And one of them, as you correctly know, is the tone a president sets, presidential tolerance for infighting. Some presidents say, I don't want to see any of this stuff. Some presidents say they like a little chaos because that brings out the best answer sometimes. So that's one, is presidential tolerance. The second is ideological comity, C-O-M-I-T-Y, not M-E-D-Y, although there is some comedy in Fight House. And the ideological comity points to the amount of agreement there is within the administration about the direction. You know, in the Reagan administration, you correctly note that there was infighting, but there was that famous phrase by Peggy Noonan where she said, the idea of Reagan ruled. Everybody knew that they were going in a conservative direction. So even if there might have been fights about particular policies or even about stature or offices or leaking, there was an overall strategic direction that came from that idea of Reagan ruling. And then the third, and this is often forgotten but extremely important, is process. There are processes that are tried and true that go from administration to administration, it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican, that determine how decisions get made in Washington. And these extremely important processes sound a little dull and stiff and political science-y, but they also determine whether people are going to feel on board and bought into the decision.
This is a very, very important point, Debbie, and I think, as you say, oftentimes to outsiders, it would appear, well, boring, but almost of little consequence compared to presidential direction, compared to ideology. But you're so right. I have not worked inside the White House, but I've certainly watched them closely, both from inside the Pentagon and outside the government altogether. And process is right up there with personnel in terms of how things get sorted out. And oftentimes, it's very much contrary, I think it's fair to say, to what one would have expected from a given president, his ideology, and so on. And the present administration comes to mind in that regard, as a matter of fact. Let me ask you just very quickly, when you have evaluated these administrations, and you've provided at the end of your book, Fight House, Debbie Troy, a scorecard that kind of helps the layperson make sense of it. Would you suggest that the average president comes down on the side of more fighting, or is there a general disposition that it's bad for business, it's bad for the perception of an orderly and effective presidency?
Yeah, that's a really sharp question, Frank. What I would say is, to the extent that there's an average president, and every president is obviously either above average or different from average, but there's definitely an endemic sense of fighting in the White House. There's always fighting in the White House. Now, sometimes, like in the Bush administration, for which I served, Bush 43, he really made sure there was little fighting on the domestic side, but in pushing down there, as you well know, Frank, there was a lot of fighting on the foreign policy and national security side. In the Obama administration, they had this theory of no drama Obama, and they made a big deal about no fighting. But as I show in the book Fight House, there actually was a bunch of fighting in the White House. So you cannot eliminate it. You can control it to some degree, you can limit it to some degree, and you can also harness it if you're wise. But you really can't eliminate fighting, and that's what makes Fight House such an enjoyable read.
It is indeed an enjoyable read. We're going to be talking more with the author of Fight House, Dr. Debbie Troy, about where this has led successive presidencies in terms of their policy approaches and their status with presidential historians like him, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're visiting with Dr. Debbie Troy, a man of many skills, but most especially and most immediately of import is his expertise as a presidential historian, having served himself inside the White House during the George W. Bush administration in the domestic policy shop, and then as the Deputy Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services. He's a man who's had a ringside view of all of this, in fact, in the arena himself for a considerable bit. But he's also got the perspective of a very, very capable historian, and it comes together beautifully in his newest book entitled Fight House, Rivalries in the White House, From Truman to Trump. Tevi, I want to focus in on two administrations that I think are particularly interesting in this regard. One is the Reagan administration. As we've discussed, I've had a chance to be inside that one myself. I remember vividly the knockdown, drag-out fights that mostly were between agencies, I think, in the case of Cap Weinberger at the Defense Department, the secretary then, for most of the Reagan years, and then his counterpart, also for most of the Reagan years, George Shultz, and the uncomfortable position that the successive national security advisors inside the White House had in trying to manage these fractious cabinet officers. What has your research showed you about the dynamic tension there and what Reagan did or didn't do to manage it?
Yeah, it's a really good point, and it's interesting that you suggest that you have some stability with the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State, which you indeed did in that administration. But at the same time, there was a bit of a revolving door when it came to the National Security Advisor. So that was an interesting way that Reagan seemed to manage, even though obviously all President Wilson had stuff generated from the White House and strategic direction from the White House. He obviously had a situation where he was trusting the cabinet secretaries, and they knew they seemed to have more stability than the National Security Advisors. Obviously, the one exception here is with Al Haig, who was the Secretary of State at the beginning of the White House, and he was not liked by the so-called triumvirate, the people who were running the White House Chief of Staff's office, specifically Jim Baker, who was the Chief of Staff, and Mike Deaver, who was the Deputy Chief of Staff. Ed Meese was the third member of the triumvirate, but he didn't have as much of a problem with Haig. And the two of them, again, Deaver and Baker, worked to keep Haig away from the president, away from Air Force One, Marine One, motorcades, etc. And Haig said, "What am I, a leper?" And he complained about the guerrillas in the White House who were out to get him. Here's what happened. Mike Deaver, 42 years old, deputy chief of staff to the White House, dresses up in a guerrilla costume in the White House and parades around saying, "I'm Baker's guerrilla," which is just astounding to me. And obviously today, when everybody has a cell phone with a camera and social media, nobody would ever think to do that today. But this happened then. And Haig obviously was out the door not long after that because he had just lost the respect of the staff through his imperious nature. So I think Reagan allowed the cabinet secretary some room, but obviously if you got out of step too much like Haig frequently did, and obviously he had that problem with the after Reagan was shot when he got up and stood. Even though he was told not to, he got up and said in front of the press corps, "I'm in charge here," specifically warned not to do that, and yet he did it anyway. So I think Reagan had a good way of understanding the tensions between the agencies and national security advisors, and he gave some deference to his cabinet secretaries to the extent they were able to handle it.
One of the most interesting pieces of that period was the formulation and the ultimate execution of the Reagan strategy for taking down the Soviet Union. And this was very much a function of one of those national security advisors' leadership, and I think his strong tie in with not only the Secretary of Defense, Cap Weinberger, with whom he had worked for a long time for Reagan out in Sacramento, but also Gene Kirkpatrick and the Director of Central Intelligence, Bill Casey. And they kind of worked around, it seems to me, initially Haig and then initially Shultz when he first took office, to really execute that strategy. And the rest, as they say, is history. So the dynamic tension that afflicted particularly the latter part of that administration was fortunately unavailing in terms of changing really the direction of the president's policy. And I think hundreds of millions of people are free of the Soviet, repression as a result.
Right. It's important to say just one point on that, Frank, is, you say the strategic direction. What was Reagan's strategic direction? What was his plan for the Cold War? We win, they lose. It doesn't get simpler than that, right? He got it in four words, and he didn't get involved in the particulars of every policy, but his cabinet secretaries and his national security advisors knew that was the overall approach.
I think there was an effort, though, as that fighting became more fractious later in the presidency, Tevi, to try to walk it back a bit, prop up Gorbachev, prop up the Soviets, and fortunately, as I say, it was unavailing. Let me turn to Obama, because he's also a fascinating character. Talk a little bit about, if you would, the dynamics within his White House as it relates to specifically some of the most radical policies any president has pursued in the national security space. I'm thinking both of some of the specific actions that he undertook, like, you know, overthrowing Gaddafi in Libya, for example, and some of the policies that really transformed. We're watching the effects of it today. The character of the Pentagon and the military leadership of the United States. Evidence of the fighting in those regards?
Yeah. So the Obama administration, as I said earlier, had this theory or even a myth of no drama Obama. There's no fighting in the Obama administration. We all get along. But we know that wasn't completely true. And there were some interesting divisions within the Obama White House. And one was kind of young versus old. They were the older, more establishment Democrats who you and I might not agree with them, but they were kind of within the same parameters that we're operating with. And then there was a younger, more radical element. And Jim Jones, who was the first national security advisor, disliked those kind of younger, as he called them, the water bugs, famously. But remember, he didn't last very long in the administration. And then the kind of leader of that younger group was a guy named Ben Rhodes. Now, Ben Rhodes is someone who is so hostile to Israel that in his own memoir, he recounts that his nickname was Hamas. And he even gives an example of usage, as in Rahm Emanuel says, Hamas here, pointing to Rhodes, is going to make it so I can't even go to my kid's bar mitzvah in Jerusalem. And Rahm Emanuel being Rahm Emanuel, there are a couple of words interspersed in there that I can't say over the radio. But to imagine somebody being so anti-Israel that you would even acknowledge or celebrate that your nickname within the White House is Hamas is something that is just mind-blowing to me. But Rhodes recounts in his memoir that he was the leader of this younger group. And when you had the whole Arab Spring uprisings, and there's questions about what to do about President Mubarak in Egypt, who, for all his flaws, was a longstanding ally of the U.S., and Rhodes was in the camp of drop this guy, drop him fast. And that initially had some really very bad repercussions in terms of the Muslim Brotherhood taking over the country, and it was just sort of short-sighted. This doesn't mean we should have been propping up Mubarak indefinitely, but to drop a leader like that so quickly and so precipitously had ripples and negative repercussions. So there was this sense of the younger Rhodes-led aides against the older, more establishment types.
Yeah, I guess I would just add to that, you know, it wasn't just that he was for throwing Mubarak, he was for embracing the Muslim Brotherhood, as were others in the administration, of course, but he seems to have been one of the real prime movers behind this. And also, by the way, the policy towards Iran, which was one of Obama's signature achievements, as he saw it, a disaster, I think, by most objective measures, but nonetheless, something that Ben Rhodes was very aggressively pursuing. And it's a little unclear to me, you know, whether there was any real opposition to that policy inside the Obama White House. Did you detect any? This seemed to be something driven pretty much by the president in that case, Tevi Troy. But were there, in fact, sensible adults somewhere in the mix who were saying, maybe this isn't a great idea?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because it really was driven by the president, and this whole Iran approach was Obama-driven. And I think you know, there's some people who might have disagreed a little bit. I think Secretary Gates, who again was a Republican in a Democratic administration, which puts him in somewhat weaker position. But there were some questioning about it. But overall, it was driven hard by Obama, and Rhodes pushed it. And there was a legendary New York Times Magazine piece written by a guy named David Samuels, who was actually a high school classmate of mine. And in it, Rhodes brags about the way he manipulates bloggers and the mainstream media to be supportive of the administration's Iran policy. And after this article comes out, with causes a huge kerfuffle, Obama calls Rhodes in to the Oval Office to talk to him about it. And you'd think maybe he would get chided or something for, you know, the way he's manipulating the press and the way he's pushing this problematic policy. And the only question Obama said to Rhodes was, did you really have to show them how the sausage was made? Suggesting that Obama had no problem with the creation of the sausage, no problem with the problematic policy. His only problem was letting people know how they did it.
And there was a boastfulness about Rhodes that read people in on a lot of that sausage making, I think certainly to the incredulity of a lot of us, especially his contempt for the press, as well as his overt manipulation of them, as you say. A fascinating inside insight into that particular White House. Tevi, of course, we couldn't complete this conversation without some discussion of the present White House. And when we come back from a short break, I want to just visit with you about some of the fundamentals. I appreciate that we're not at the end of this presidency, and historians don't like to be asked about these sorts of things as they're in the works. But it would be helpful to just get your appreciation, based on White House, of how the president of this administration is managing the infighting inside his own wire. That and much more with Dr. Tevi Troy, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are visiting for this full hour with a distinguished former public servant, a presidential historian, an author of several very important books, including the one we're discussing at the moment, White House, Rivalries in the White House from Truman to Trump. His name is Dr. Tevi Troy. He has both firsthand experience inside the fighting White Houses, and also in the executive branch agencies, including where he served as the deputy secretary in the Department of Health and Human Services. Tevi, I did want to just bring us up to the moment. You talk about, though it's very much with the admission that it's a work in progress, of course, the Trump White House. The headlines are, of course, at the moment filled with reporting on various internal skirmishing and worse. And without getting into a lot of the particulars, which is probably inappropriate to do given they're still very much in flux, talk about how Donald Trump has structured his White House with respect to his own presidential direction on infighting, with respect to his own sort of ideological compass, and with respect to the process that he's used to make decisions.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, Frank. As you know, as a historian, I like to tell the story after the story is fully told. So with Obama, for example, we talked about No Drama Obama. And if you wrote the book during the Obama administration, it would be about, oh, no drama Obama, there's no fighting. And then I found all kinds of interesting stories about fights that did take place that weren't reported on at the time that made for a more interesting chapter on Obama. So there's just that caveat that you don't know the full story while it's going on. And I look forward to the archives opening and getting more memoirs from people who served in the entire time in the administration, even the Bush administration in which I served. The oral histories just came online in 2019, 10 years after Bush stopped serving. So the Trump oral histories probably won't be available until 2031 or 2035, depending on what happens in the upcoming election. That said, obviously, there's been a lot of discussion about fighting in the current administration, and there's a lot of talk about the Bolton memoir, which just came out this week. And it seems like Trump has had different iterations in his administration. First, he started out with Reince Priebus, who was was not one of the stronger chiefs of staff, I think, by design. And then they moved to General Kelly to have kind of the more militaristic and more process-driven approach. And it did seem like there was more process imposed after that. And then you had Mick Mulvaney, who seemed more ideologically aligned, whereas Kelly was less of an ideological person. And now I really can't speak to the current chief of staff because he's so new, but obviously also comes from Congress like Mulvaney. And so there's some ideological alignment. We don't yet know his management style. So I think we see this sometimes in previous administrations, that different types of chief of staff indicate different types of operations going on. In the White House in the Carter administration, for example, there was a reluctance to even have a chief of staff at the beginning, partly in reaction to the Nixon administration, because nobody liked the fact that Nixon had these chiefs of staff in terms of Haldeman, who was seen as kind of imperious. And so Carter didn't have a chief of staff initially. Then he brings in his political strategist as chief of staff, who is not effective in Hamilton Jordan. And then finally, at the end, he brings in Jack Watson as chief of staff, who is effective, so much so that Ronald Reagan, at the inauguration, kind of finds Watson and says to him, you know, from what I hear, if you'd been in that job, meaning chief of staff, from the beginning, then we wouldn't be here right now, meaning Reagan wouldn't have won the election if Carter had started out with the right processes. So it takes presidents, including this one, time to find the right grounding and the right staffing approach.
All right. So having said that, what can we assess at the moment is the president's attitude towards infighting? Is the president's approach to a kind of ideological, well, for want of a better term, compass? And his, with the acknowledgement of what you've just said about the changing chiefs of staff, is there any way you can characterize how this process seems to be operating? Is it top-down directed? Is it something that basically is just a question of managing the paper flow of what's coming up from the agencies, some combination of the two? What?
Well, recall we talked about the three levers that a president has to control things, which are ideological alignment, process, and presidential tolerance. President Trump has said that he has tolerance for infighting. He said he likes conflict. The ideological alignment, I think, is something that has sorted out a little bit over time, in that in the early days, it wasn't clear the direction the administration was going to go, and there were a lot of people from different perspectives. Now it seems like the new personnel office is saying, we do have a philosophy, and let's make sure people adhere to it. So, again, it is evolving. We'll see how things play out over the next couple of months. But it seems to be like the most intense of the infighting was in the early days when you see this in previous administrations. The Clinton administration also, the very early days were incredibly chaotic, so much so that there were articles written about how the Clinton administration is a failure, and there were people in the Clinton administration saying, we've only been in office 2 weeks, you know, give us a break, guys.
Well, I remember famously, of course, my friend Steve Bannon's role in contributing a bit to the chaos. There's also the role that I think is unique in this administration, at least as far as I can recall. Not that there aren't obviously important contributions made by first ladies. That's always the case, I think. But the presence inside the White House of Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump is unique and contributes, it seems, to some of this interesting internal dynamic and tension. And again, we'll wait for the historians to get their hands on the oral histories and the cumulative results of all of this before making judgments. But a fascinating time to be a presidential historian, for sure. And I know you're chomping at the bit to write the next chapter. Let me just ask you before we run out of time, Chevy, about what are your takeaways from all of this? What is your best advice to a president, or perhaps a future president, as to how to wend your way through the temptations or the inevitabilities of conflict in the White House to get the best results for the American people?
Yeah, so I think the first thing is the president has to ask himself some threshold questions, such as what amount of chaos or infighting am I willing to tolerate? If you say none, the problem too, because in the Vietnam War, Lyndon Johnson didn't want to hear any dissenting views, and that led to not only to problematic policies, but an unwillingness of people to discuss it. In fact, in Fight House, I tell the story of some State Department aides who were a little uncomfortable with the direction of Vietnam policy, and they formed a group, but they called it the non-group, and they met at secret times so that Johnson wouldn't find out that there were dissenters within the ranks. So you've got to just decide what your level of tolerance is for this kind of infighting, and you have to have some, otherwise you don't have full and open and honest discussions. The second is process, and you really can't go wrong with a good process. It's not an ideological thing, it's not a partisan thing. If you have a good process, it's going to lead to better results. Sometimes you overdo it. In the Bush administration, there was so much process, I'm talking about Bush 41, there was so much process that they didn't get stuff done. There was kind of a sclerotic halting of any policy discussions, and in fact the aides kind of cheekily made up these buttons, and one of them called Born to Process, and process is kind of where policies went to die. And then the third is you've got to lay out your ideology in a clear way so people know the direction of the administration, and as I said earlier, Reagan was good at that.
Let me go back just to the process pit for a moment, if I can, Tevi, because having been inside the bureaucracy myself, as have you, I know it's important, as we've been discussing, but what would a good process be, as you see it?
A good process means you know how decisions are made, who is at the table when the decisions are made, what the timetables are. In fact, when I was at the Domestic Policy Council, that was my job. I called myself a station manager. There are multiple policy trains moving, and you have to help decide which ones are going to make it to the station of a meeting with the president. Some can get decided at a lower level, at deputies committees or principals committees, what speed they have to move at because what's the urgency, and who is going to be on the train, meaning what people are participating in the conversation. And if you have a meeting about, let's say, criminal justice reform, and you didn't include the attorney general, well, you know, that's a bad process. So I think these are things, again, that are nonpartisan, non-ideological, but you need to have the right people at the table, and you need to have the meetings done in the right way so that you can have a full and honest discussion.
I guess to some extent, this always comes down, doesn't it, to that first principle of government that Ronald Reagan famously coined of personnel as policy. To the extent that the president, going back to what we talked about with Reagan, to the extent the president wants strong people in his cabinet and is willing to entrust to them responsibility for developing and not just executing, but really being the, you know, pointy end of the spear with respect to his policies, you have a different process, I assume, than you would if you really are going to run things from the White House. And to the extent that you're, you know, again, providing your best counsel to a future president, let's say, where would you come down on that? Is it best run if you want a strong president in a strong, productive presidency to have it essentially a White House run operation through and through? Or is a devolution of power managed in a presumably fairly transparent fashion? You didn't use that term, but I'd ask you about that in process as well from, you know, the position of places like the Domestic Policy Council.
It is a great question, and there really is this notion, and it's a recurrent theme I found in the book In Fight House, that you have presidents call for what's called cabinet government, meaning the cabinet secretaries run the show, they develop policies. But when they call for cabinet government, they don't actually want cabinet government because they want the decisions made at the White House. Nixon was famous for this. He kept saying cabinet government, but he didn't actually mean it. So I think presidents should just be honest. Major strategic directives come from the White House, but the development of the policy and the hard work and the writing of the position papers necessarily has to come from the cabinet agencies because they're the ones that are staffed and equipped to do it. So I think you have to be honest about what you want and have a realistic plan for getting there.
Great answer. Tevi, we're going to take a last break, and when we come back, we're going to switch gears a bit to the subject of your other really important book, Shall We Wake the President? And a discussion of disasters, natural and otherwise, including the COVID-19 pandemic. That and more with Tevi Troy straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for the fourth and final installment of this extraordinarily interesting conversation with the author of Fight House, Rivalries in the White House from Truman to Trump. We're going to switch gears, though, as I said, to talk a little bit about one of your other areas of expertise, notably from your time as the Deputy Director of the Department of Health and Human Services, namely how a federal government presidency responds to disasters. And we have one upon us now, for sure, a pandemic induced by what I call the Chinese Communist Party virus. But it is just one of the sorts of things that you recount in your book have confronted and really afflicted presidencies of both parties. And you describe, you know, how to respond to these sorts of crises. And I'd be interested, generally, again, what lessons you've learned from your personal involvement in crisis management, but also your chronicling of previous ones. And then we'll talk a little bit about the present crisis.
Great. Well, in my book, In Shall We Wake the President, which happens to be ironically just out in paperback this spring. In that book, I look at the issue of disasters and how presidents have responded to them, but I also recognize that individuals have a stake in this, and I give recommendations for each type of disaster, whether it's a weather-related event or a disease outbreak or urban riots, all things that we've seen in recent years, what individuals should do to prepare themselves so they can protect themselves and their families. Because one of the lessons of the book is you can't count on the federal government to come bail you out in a problem. The federal government can do certain things like help develop a vaccine or give strategic direction, but the federal government doesn't come to your house and help you out with your specific problem. So it really addresses both sides of the equation, and in large part because throughout the 19th century, in the beginning of this country, there was not an expectation that presidents got involved in disasters. It's not mentioned in the Constitution. We didn't have the communications or the transportation apparatus for Washington to be involved in disasters. And it's really only a 20th and now 21st century phenomenon that you have such presidential involvement. So that's really the framework of the book, Shall We Wake the President?
And to the extent that this has become very much a responsibility of the president, de facto, if not de jure, Tevi, is the government of the United States properly organized to deal with these sorts of crises? And let me just ask you specifically about pandemic. We've had now some hard experience with this one, and we've seen, it seems, a lot of sort of making it up on the fly. But when you were in office and subsequent to that, were preparations that were known to be needed not made that we have to learn the lessons of going forward?
Yeah, it's a great point, Frank. In what the administration in which I served, the George W. Bush administration, there was a lot of focus on this issue of pandemic preparedness. And I think George W. Bush did great work in increasing our pandemic preparedness and creating three lines of defense against these possible outbreaks. Number one was better international cooperation, so we know what's going to happen. Number two is ability to track and trace people when they come into the country if they have a disease. And number three is a strategic national stockpile that has countermeasures that can be deployed to any part in the country at any time if there is a crisis and if they are needed. And what happened in this particular case was all three lines of defense failed us, unfortunately. You mentioned the Chinese complicity in this. One of the issues with this particular disease was the Chinese were not honest and upfront about what was going on at an early enough time where we could have done more about it. So that was the first line of defense. The second is the track and trace, which relies on testing. And obviously in the early days, we did not have the testing. The other thing was the problem of asymptomatic spread, which we've rarely seen a disease that is this deadly, but also this efficient in transmission. Ebola, for example, in 2014 was quite deadly. In fact, deadlier than this, but there's no transmission from asymptomatic people. If you had the symptoms of Ebola, that's when you were contagious and you weren't getting out of bed. I mean, I remember somebody would talk about a possible bioweapon of people with Ebola going on the trains or the metro. That's not happening because if you have Ebola, you're not getting on a train. You're not getting out of bed. And then the third is the countermeasure. And I actually wrote in my book in 2016 in Shall We Wake the President that we did not have countermeasures for coronavirus. Coronaviruses had struck before, the MERS, the SARS, and we know that they are a problem. We just didn't have a vaccine platform or an antiviral that worked on these kinds of coronaviruses, and I said in the book we needed to develop them because the whole idea of a strategic national stockpile is you have the materials you need, the medical countermeasures you need in case something bad happens. And unfortunately, with coronaviruses, we didn't have them when the time struck.
Alas, we still don't have them, and we're certainly suffering the consequences. So given all of that, Tevi Troy, as you know, a professional with some serious time in service in this space, what would your recommendation be to President Trump and his team, the vice president obviously heading up this coronavirus task force, for things to be done that aren't being done at the moment? I'm not just talking about, you know, contending with this CCP virus. I'm talking about basically learning the lessons and applying sort of an updated, perhaps three-strand approach of the kind you've just mentioned with much greater, well, vigor and hopefully effect for the future. Because this is, I'm sorry to say, this is not going to be the last pandemic, I suspect, if only because others have surely seen, and I'm frankly suspicious that the Chinese are among them, but others have seen that this is a very potent way to do vast harm to the United States. And so whether this was actually a biological attack or whether it's just worked out as a sort of proof of concept in a very, very troubling way. We're going to see more of this, I think. So what else needs to be done at this point, Tevi, that isn't, as you can see?
Right. So first of all, you need to break these two important questions that you ask into two separate categories. Number one is, what do we need to do right now to help fix the problem? And number two is, what do we do to prepare for the future so that we don't face this again? Let me take the second one first in terms of, I agree that there are likely to be more pandemics in the future, but that doesn't mean they're coming tomorrow. So I don't think people should panic and assume that we're in a new mode where there's a pandemic every week. The reason I was talking about in my book, my wariness of a pandemic, is I said we seem to overdue because these things seem to happen every 60 years or so. They don't happen every week. So I think once we get past this, I don't think people should panic or be in complete shutdown mode for the rest of their lives. We get past this, we can get past this, and it may not happen again tomorrow or next week, or maybe even in our lifetimes. But we do need to think strategically about how we're better ready with that three-pronged approach going forward. The first question about what to do right now, it's a little hard to say because there's so much going on inside the government that I'm just not privy to as someone who's not there. But one thing that I can point to is that we have a hybrid healthcare system, right? It's not fully private. It's not fully public. Some people want it to be more private. Some people want it to be more public. But I think we need to embrace the hybrid nature of our system and recognize that the thing that the government is good at doing in terms of identifying what the problems are and incentivizing people to develop the countermeasures, but then the private sector is better at actually developing and massing up and scaling to create the countermeasures. And I think that's really what the focus should be on this disease in the future. Make sure to use the advantages of the government to do what it can do, but also take full advantage of the private sector to do what it can do.
All right. So this is the pregnant question on my mind as we think about specifically vaccines, assuming we can come up with a vaccine for a coronavirus, and apparently we haven't succeeded at doing that yet. Bill Gates is determined to insert into such a vaccine a nanochip, which would become part of the healthcare monitoring and tracking systems of the future, something eerily akin to what the Chinese have been developing in terms of their so-called social credit system. Tevi Troy is a serious public policy professional with some, as I say, chops in the healthcare space particularly. A, what do you think of that idea? And B, what do you think of, well, the idea that's being bruited by people like Alan Dershowitz that it ought to be compulsory to have such a vaccine?
Yeah, so there are, from a public perspective, there are potential advantages to that in being able to monitor challenges and identify if there is some kind of disease outbreak and monitor compliance and all that. But also, as you're suggesting, there are huge privacy concerns with it. So I think there needs to be a fuller public policy process where we sort through this. At the same time, there is an urgency of it now where we have to get a vaccine out today or yesterday or even sooner. So to combine the nanochip idea, which again has some public health promise to privacy concerns, with the urgency of the now, I think is dangerous. I think we need to go forward with the vaccine as quickly as we can get it out without getting caught up in these side issues, and leave that debate for another day.
Well, that is a politic answer. I appreciate your getting it across in the time available, too. Thank you very much, Tevi, for your time throughout this hour. It's been very informative, I think, and hopefully will be the kind of thing that will benefit not just our audience, but presidents as they contend with these issues of internal divisions and also disasters as well. Keep up the good work, my friend, and do come back to us with updates if you would. In the meantime, I hope you'll stay well and safe. I hope the rest of you will do the same and that you'll return to us again next week. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.